Let's just go back into the Gorgias text, and what we'll cover today is from page 87 to the top of page 108. And the primary topic of this section is hedonism. And the reason why that is that at the end of our last session, we saw that Gorgias announces that he is a hedonist, that he argues that ruling oneself, meaning disciplining one's desires, is for suckers, and that the good life is the life of having as big an appetite as you possibly can have and satisfying it. Socrates says, well, what about ruling yourself? And the argument then becomes whether or not the good life is a life of self-indulgence or self-discipline. And another way of putting this is the question, is the good life, or is freedom, I should say, a matter of self-indulgence or self-discipline? Because remember, freedom and power are central themes in this dialogue. So you could also put the question, is power a matter of self-indulgence, the ability to indulge yourself or the ability to discipline yourself? And Socrates, of course, argues for the claim that true freedom, true power, true happiness comes through the life of self-discipline, the life of virtue, rather than the life of self-indulgence. And there are three arguments that he lays out that I think are rather nice, and they completely defeat Callicles' hedonism. And the best thing to do is just to sort of lay these out on the board, and then we can talk about them one by one. Because if we just go through the give and take, the yes and no of it all, it becomes tedious and hard to follow. So here's the first argument. I formulate it this way. The good, which is equal to happiness, and the bad, which is equated with wretchedness, cannot exist in the same person at the same time and in the same respect. We'll spell out all of these
qualifiers there.
Yes, exactly. We'll spell all these out later. Pleasure and pain associated with this desire, okay, desire and satisfaction can exist in the same person at the same time. And the conclusion is, therefore, pleasure is not the same as the good, and pain is not the same as the bad. Okay, so let's talk about what this all means. First of all, premise one, the good, which is identified as happiness, and the bad, which is wretchedness, cannot exist in the same person at the same time. What does that mean? You can't be miserable and happy at the same time, wretched and happy at the same time. And now somebody might say, well, can't you be wretched about the fact that you got your shoes or your feet wet in a puddle, and yet sublimely happy at the fact that you're sitting listening to, say, Mozart's The Magic Flute? Can't you be both happy and wretched at the same time? And this is why the qualifier in the same respect is also there. Okay. The same time and in the same respect. If you're wretched because you have wet feet and happy because you're listening to Mozart, that's wretchedness and happiness in different respects, right? But can you be wretched and happy listening to Mozart? Or can you be wretched and happy because your feet are wet? Socrates says no. Wretchedness and happiness exclude one another, so you can't be both wretched and happy at the same time and in the same precise way. However, pleasure and pain, and we understand this here as desire, pain is desire, right? Desire is painful because it's our awareness of things that we lack. And satisfaction, which brings pleasure, can exist in the same person at the same time. So, for instance, Socrates gives the example of the pain of thirst and the pleasure of drinking. Isn't it the case that if you come in out of the hot weather and you're thirsty, you're feeling pain, and as you drink, you're feeling pleasure at the same time? And I didn't put in the same respect because I'm not quite sure if you can make that claim, right? In one way,
you could say that you're feeling pleasure insofar as you're satisfying yourself and feeling pain insofar as you haven't fully satisfied yourself. So maybe this proviso of the same respect doesn't apply there.
But the conclusion is this. Pleasure is not equal to the good and pain is not equal to the bad because pleasure and pain can exist in a person in a different way than the good and the bad. If they have different modes of existence, they can't be the same thing.
Can you find instances where a person is both wretched and happy at the same time in the same respect? Can you think of any examples? Think of all the causes of happiness and all the causes of wretchedness. But the point is, would you be happy and unhappy in the same respect? I mean, you might be saying, well, you know, it's a chance to be a hero, and that doesn't come along, so there's something good about that, and I believe in the cause. But on the other hand, I'll be dead. You know, it's on the one hand and on the other hand. And so there is, in a sense, different respects to the issue that are being weighed as, you know, differently. So I think that example would fit in with what Socrates says. Clearly, there have to be certain causes of the wretchedness, right? And those would probably be different than the causes of the happiness.
The way Socrates would handle it is he'd say, well, let's disaggregate this. Let's break this down. To define what an event is, to individuate what an event is a tricky kind of problem. For instance, World War II is an event, right? It's a big, long event, but it consists of many, 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 many smaller events. And some of these smaller events can be broken down into other smaller events, right? And so you can say, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, right, about, say, the French Revolution, or before the French Revolution. But it literally wasn't the best and worst of times in the same respect, right? And so you can start breaking these things down. And the sublime is it's not merely physical, there's some psychological component, but it has a kind of both an elevation and a kind of sinking feeling at the same time. But in different respects. That's how, if you look at Kant, for instance, or Schiller, when they analyze the sublime, they can break it down into the different aspects. What causes the sinking feeling and what causes the exaltation. It really is true that there are lots of pleasures that seem to coexist with pains. Taking pleasure in being scared in more general ways, like going to horror movies. That's kind of pleasure-pain thing.
Another way of understanding this is, in a sense, the good and happiness refer to soul states, right? Whereas pleasure and pain are body states. There's something more lasting about happiness than there is about getting yourself tickled or your... In tickling, now there's an example. Is it pleasure or pain? Well, it's sort of both. The body is amazingly subjectible to these pleasure-pain conjunctions. And just drinking and being thirsty. The pleasure of drinking and the pain of being thirsty coexist at the same time. And you really wouldn't take pleasure in the drinking if you didn't also have that pain there. And the clearest example of that is that when you're satiated, when the pain is gone, there's no more pleasure in it. Right? This always happens to me during holiday meals. You know, holiday meals, they're always piling on the food. And there's a point where you become satiated and the food becomes repulsive, right? There's no pleasure in it anymore because there's no pain at the same time, namely the pain of hunger. And this brings us to the next argument. So let's go on to it. Second argument, the good and the bad. And again, good is happiness and the bad is wretchedness.
Where are we going to put that?
There's no ugly in this. They do not cease together. The ceasing of the good is the bad, vice versa. Ceasing of the bad is the good. They don't end at the same time. When one ends, the other begins. That's his claim. When you talk about the good and the bad. And of course, this is the beginning of the soul. We're talking about happiness.
That's just a variation of the first.
The second premise is this. Pleasure and pain cease at the same time. So, right, when you eat and you become full, the pleasure of eating ceases at the same time as the pain of hunger ceases. And so, the good is not equal to pleasure,
and the bad is not equal to pain.
Again, they have different modes of being, right? The good and the bad exist successively. They come into being and pass out of existence in succession, not simultaneously. Whereas pleasure and pain cease at the same time. So that's a different way of being, if you will, in time. It's a kind of temporal difference in the form of existence. Therefore, the good isn't the same as pleasure, and the bad isn't the same as pain. Now, this next argument has three premises. The good is good because of the presence of goodness. Who could complain about that, right? A good thing. A good thing is good because of the presence of goodness. Number two. A bad thing is bad because of the presence. Premise three is this. Good and bad men both. And what else? Good and bad men both have pleasure and pain about equally. Now, you might add a fourth premise here, but I'll leave it out just for the sake of space, and I'll just explain what it might be. Pleasure cannot be the cause of goodness. That is to say, it's not equal to the good. And pain can't be the cause of badness. It's not equal to the bad, if you will. Now, the refinement that I guess you could add to premise three is this, is that good and bad men are good and bad and remain good and bad throughout the enjoyment of pleasure and the suffering of pain. It doesn't fundamentally transform who they are. So, he talks about the example of cowards, right? Cowards in battle rejoice when the enemy leaves more than the brave men do, and they suffer more when the enemy charges than the brave men do. But they're no less cowards for their rejoicing, and they're no more cowards for their suffering. The first two premises are basic Platonism. What makes something good? Well, it has some goodness. It participates, if you will, in the former idea of the good. It takes part of goodness, you know, in a very literal sense. It has some goodness in it. So what makes this water good? Well, it's got some goodness. That's the secret ingredient. What makes something bad? Well, it's got some badness in it. It's very simple. It almost seems like a cheat. But you have to admit that bad things have got something bad about them, and that's all he's saying. And that a thing becomes bad by acquiring something bad about it. But good men and bad men suffer pleasure and pain without being transformed into something else. And if goodness is precisely what makes a person good, and pleasure is goodness, then wouldn't a bad man who enjoys pleasure become a good man, right? And if badness is pain, then pain would be the thing that confers badness. So wouldn't a good man become a bad man through suffering? But you don't observe that. Give me an example. You think that the reason why he became that way is that he suffered? Yeah, but there might have been this very same guys doing the same sorts of things who had come away with it very differently. And you have to ask, what was the factor that caused people with similar experiences to have different reactions? And that would have to be something that would have to do with their character to begin with. What you're saying would be basically in accordance with what Socrates is saying.
Exactly.
The bad men don't become any worse by suffering, and they don't become any better by enjoyment, right? I hate to say it, but I'll just say it. Maybe this guy was sort of made out of weak stuff to begin with, and it didn't manifest itself because he had a fairly okay environment. But when he was put under stress, he cracked, okay? And so Socrates might say, look, he wasn't all that good to begin with if by suffering he became really bad. You know, a lot of people suffer terribly when they're sick. Some people just give in and become, you know, mopers and bitchers and whiners, and they make everybody else around them miserable too. Whereas some stronger people don't, you know. Yeah, the doctors and nurses all know about this, I'm sure. Other people who are made out of stronger stuff are more, in a sense, sensitive to the people around them, but also they have a greater capacity to control themselves, and they don't end up becoming embittered or just dissolved as a responsible person by the suffering that they undergo. They're not, you know, full of self-pity and things like that. Socrates would say, look, people can really suffer terrible things, but if they have strong character, they won't be made into bad people. The people of weak character or bad character, the suffering will make a difference to them, perhaps. But the point is that if pleasure can't cause a bad person to become good, then pleasure isn't the same as goodness, because goodness would be the thing that would cause a bad person to become good. The assumption is that people can become better, but they don't become better by having a good time. They become better through some kind of internal moral transformation. There's some kind of rectification of the will. That's ultimately what makes a bad person turn better. Or, for Socrates, it's also going to be the removal of ignorance. In a sense, the rectification of the will. Well, you can understand that in this way. Some people follow their pleasures. Whenever they have a choice, they choose the more pleasant thing. And in a sense, you can say that that's, if they change their habitual choices towards doing the good, then that's a kind of rectification of the will. Socrates would say, but the fact of the matter is that the real will is towards the good anyway. And what would lead them to rectify their choices would be to overcome their own ignorance of what's where their good really lies. Right? People who do bad things only do it under the guise of the good. So in a sense, the most fundamental thing is knowledge versus ignorance for him. To know the good is to do the good in normal circumstances. So the people who do bad things do it out of ignorance or error. It's a very, in a sense, optimistic attitude. I got in a I'm embarrassed to admit it, but I've gotten involved in debates on the internet recently. And my God, the time just flies. Fortunately, so far, I've disciplined myself a bit, and I've only been involved in things that I think are beneficial to me. But that probably won't last much longer. I only debate on topics where I'd like to clarify my own thinking. People were arguing about self-sacrifice. And this one person was basically using Ayn Rand's definition of sacrifice as giving up a greater value to a lesser value. And I said, it doesn't happen. There are two interpretations of the claim that, you know, sacrifice is giving up a greater value to a lesser value. One would be a psychological interpretation, which would be that a person gives up something that they regard as good for something that they regard as less good. Now, on the Socratic principle, that's just not possible. Because we're oriented towards the good, we're pursuing the good, and that means that we always choose the thing that we think is best. But the other interpretation is that it's a claim about what's objectively good. Some people, as a matter of fact, give up things of greater value to lesser value. And that's true. People do that all the time. But the point is, they would only do that out of ignorance and error. And so nobody actually advocates sacrifice in the sense that Rand defines it. They might advocate what amounts to sacrifice out of ignorance or error, but people's actual behavior is always directed towards what they think is the good. And so we got in this big debate, and it got kind of interesting. But the point is that there are people out there who really believe that human beings are very knowing and very evil. There are people who are arguing that there are people who actually hate the good because it's good. I don't know. I just don't know. Or choose things that are evil because they think they're evil. As I would understand it, it's something like this. Somebody who's into Satan. You know, Satan is bad, and Jesus is good. But if somebody prefers Satan to Jesus, it's because on some level they really don't believe these judgments of bad and good to begin with. Right? And that on a deeper level, they think that Satan is better than Jesus. Why? The core of this, though, is the sense that self-assertion is good, right? And self-assertion is a good thing. And a lot of people, through whatever vagaries of their upbringing and so forth, find that the necessary self-assertion as part of the process of becoming an adult, an individual, and so forth, sets them at odds with opinions, namely parental opinions, right, about what's good. And so they will affirm things that are evil. But the question is, do they really believe that they're worse? Or do they actually think that people are really sort of wrong about this? And that it's really better for them to mutilate cats or, you know, get into vampirism and things like that. My thought is that they really think it's better in some sense, although they might maintain the categories of good and evil and say that they're really bad, right? The Socratic position is that people are a lot more ignorant and a lot less evil. Milton's Satan, right? Even Satan is not evil, you know, in the Milton account. He's simply self-assertive. The claim that people do evil because it's evil or hate things that are good because they're good presupposes that people are highly knowing, right? They know what's good and they reject it as such. They know what's evil and they reject it as such. The Socratic claim is that people are less evil than that, but far more ignorant. Because when somebody does something that we recognize to be evil, they're not doing it because they think it's evil. Although they might say, we're really bad, you know, we gothic kids. One could argue, look, you see a lot of random violence and cruelty because human beings have needs for individuation and self-assertion that are not given any kind of proper cultivation. Right? This movie that I'm looking forward to, Fight Club, I think could be profound in dealing with that kind of issue. Yeah, I got this person who was saying, you know, the Sermon on the Mount is preaching evil. It's preaching sacrifice. And so I pulled out the Sermon on the Mount and I read that and I thought, you know, there's nothing in the Sermon on the Mount that says you need to take things that you regard as real values and subordinate them to things you regard as less than real values. All it says is that there are a lot of things that people think are valuable that are less valuable than they really are, and that people need to rectify their thinking and get the right priorities, which is an entirely different view. It's not saying, you know, sacrifice greater values to lesser values, but recognize that some things really are more valuable than others, and you should pursue those. Mm-hmm. And virtually every moral philosopher and virtually every ethical statement, you know, out there does not require or ask that you take greater values and subordinate them to lesser ones. No Christian thinker, for no matter how self-mortifying, ever said, for instance, that you should give up your own salvation to assure the salvation of somebody else. So the history of thought, of ethics, is not a history in any sense of, if you will, of altruism, in the sense of giving up greater values to lesser values, or sacrifice in that sense. Whenever somebody says that you should, usually when people use the word sacrifice, they mean giving up something of lesser value to something that's greater. It means giving up something. It's an exchange, though, usually trading up. And if people talk about sacrificing something that's valuable, the general sense is that it's less valuable than the thing you're giving it up for. For someone like Socrates, you know, the evil is equivalent to sickness. And sickness can be cured in some sense. Sometimes it can't be cured, and you just have to euthanize the person. That's why he believes in capital punishment for incorrigibly awful people. But with that therapeutic orientation, there's still absolutely no sense that, well, you know, the person is not responsible. Okay. But there is a sense in which they're not responsible. But put it this way, he's never going to say that a human being is responsible for choosing the evil as such. Okay. And that's a kind of diabolical notion of evil that seems very foreign to the Greek temperament. If you want to look at, say, theologies in the 17th and 18th century, one of the things that creeps back in is this kind of Socratic optimism about human beings. So, for instance, Leibniz, in his Theodicy, has an account of eternal damnation because he has to maintain this. He's, you know, writing for a Calvinist king and everything. But the way he conceives it is that the only person who would be eternally damned is a person who chooses to be. And it's very clear, though, that he thinks that human beings would never choose that as such, right, or choose evil as such. There's a kind of Socratic optimism that comes back in. But Christianity is associated with this notion of a kind of demonic evil or diabolical evil. I just don't know if people are that knowing and that wicked. Being a good citizen is not necessarily the same thing as being a good man. It might be required of you to be a bad citizen to be a good man sometimes, but that's certainly not the case with Alcibiades. What do you have here? Well, in Plato's view, you have a human being with enormous capacities, and the more enormous one's capacities are, the more the more capability of doing good and evil one has. And then the question is the poor guy was deeply deluded. Well, he certainly wasn't deeply deluded by hanging around with Socrates. He was deeply deluded by the populace of Athens, right? He would have been a lot worse without Socrates. Two of the most interesting gestures in Platonic dialogues have to do with Alcibiades. Aside from Socrates, Alcibiades is the person who's mentioned most in the Platonic dialogues. But it's very interesting, in the Symposium, he arrives roaring drunk after all the speeches about love are over. You know, all of us who've read it are educated. All of us who read it hear Diotima's speech about the love and the fine and everything like that. But Alcibiades doesn't hear that because he arrives too late. And when we read the Timaeus, and I hope you will all read that with me, the Timaeus begins 1, 2, 3, 4. It begins 1, 2, 3, but where is the fourth of our company? I think Alcibiades is an example of a person who, well, put it this way, he saw his good, he saw the good as lying in fame, in power, in public life. As Socrates said, you would not be content if you would rather die than be content with a private life. You know, and once you became master of Athens, you'd rather die than be content with that because you would want to become master of the entire world. And why does a person have this ambition? Well, because they think that that's where the good is. And Socrates says, Alcibiades, you'll never achieve this without me. He baits the hook as best he can. He promises him world power, which is what he really wants, if he just listens to philosophy. And he gives a pretty good speech, but the fact of the matter is that in two of the dialogues, where all the important stuff is being set out, Alcibiades is absent. He's not there listening when he should be. And I think that those little gestures are indications of what went wrong. He didn't know the good. Socrates tried everything he could with the guy, but he just didn't know the good because he didn't learn it. He had other teachers that he listened to more, namely the populace. They were enormously supportive and they flattered him. He was very good looking. He was very popular. And he was very much corrupted by the flattery of the crowds. And as it turns out, the first lecture of my class on the Timaeus is going to be all about Socrates and Alcibiades, because I'm going to give an argument that the absent fourth person at the Timaeus was Alcibiades, and that the theme of the framework of the Timaeus and the Critias, with all of its myths about the origin of the cosmos and the sinking of Atlantis, is the context of Athens, in the Peloponnesian War, and the arrogance of its imperialism, and its well-deserved downfall. There's a political lesson to it. But the person who should have heard this lesson wasn't there. And the main characters of the dialogue are Socrates, Critias, Timaeus, and Hermocrates. And Hermocrates was the general from Syracuse who utterly destroyed the Athenians when they tried to invade Sicily. And Alcibiades was the person who put this expedition together and was suddenly yanked from its command at the last minute. And they went off and suffered an absolutely crushing defeat at the hands of this fellow. You know, so that's the context here. And it really is all about the overweening, wicked imperial ambitions of Athens, the corruption of its democracy, its imperialistic democracy, and the fact that, that the person who should have learned the lesson most wasn't there. So anyway, we'll deal with this a lot more later.